This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Joel Hilliker. America's education system is failing, according to our own government statistics. High academic standards are being abandoned in favor of other priorities, such as social justice. We'll have a conversation with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about just how serious this problem is becoming in America today. We'll also talk with personal trainer and holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian about the mathematics of health. The common idea today is that we solve the poison of a virus by injecting a second poison of an experimental vaccine. But when does 1 + 1 actually equal 0? We'll talk to Jorg about a much more logical math equation regarding our health. For the last word on today's show, we'll talk about what to do when you're caught doing something wrong. But to start the show today, German business. In a recent Key of David program, Gerald Fleury drew attention to comments from Donald Tusk that Angela Merkel said she was helpless to stop the Nord Stream 2 project because of pressure from German business leaders. It was an important peek into Germany's politics and power and the role that business and industry plays. And it has some important historical and prophetic associations as well. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello, Josue.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
So she was helpless to stand up to the pressure of German business leaders. How do we know, or do you know, who these German business leaders are that she would be referring to?
Yes, that's quite an interesting statement that she made. Apparently those business leaders are more powerful than the influence of the United States and other European leaders.
There was a lot of pressure against Nord Stream 2 from a lot of other sources, and basically all of that was not as powerful as the voices of these business leaders.
That's right. Germany's closest allies, mainly the United States and France, have both criticized the Nord Stream 2 project, and even many Germans themselves. It's a very unpopular project within Germany, so really everything spoke against it. On the surface, this is. But there are many German businesses that have close cooperation with Russia. There are 4,000 German businesses that have a presence in Russia. So that alone shows you that the two countries are closely tied together, and sanctioning Russia means essentially sanctioning Germany. So there's a lot of pressure on the German government from the business world, because if you sanction Russia and if you stop cooperating with it, German people will lose jobs and they will lose money and they will lose their economic standing. So that gives us some insight into the pressure that is on the government. Now, who exactly are those leaders? There are quite a few that have strongly cooperated with Russia, and we have seen that in the past, and they have spoken against sanctions. For example, the Siemens CEO, Joe Kaeser, visited Russian President Vladimir Putin in March 2014, just as Russia was invading the Crimea, and he spoke against sanctions. So here we have a German business leader. He is not a politician or anything like that, but he is basically telling the West what they should do. And apparently the German government listened to them rather than to the United States. Mm-hmm. There's another specific company that supports Nord Stream 2. You can go to the Nord Stream website, Nord Stream AG, and you can see all the supporters. The main supporter is the Russia state-owned company Gazprom, but even that company, it has an influential German worker. No one else other than the former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder. He was actually the one that signed the deal with Nord Stream just before he left office in 2005. He was German Chancellor at the time, he was voted out of office, but while the transition was going on, he signed that controversial deal, and every politician after him followed him. So he works for that Russia state-owned company Gazprom. But next to Gazprom is another company that supports this pipeline, and that's Wintershall Dea, a subsidiary of BASF, Germany's largest chemical company and really the largest chemical company in the world in that field. So Wintershall Dea also supports this pipeline project. And here's a quote from the CEO, Mario Mehren, who said in 2018, Russia is the most important region for Wintershall, and Russia will remain the most important region for Wintershall. So clearly he says, we are not going to cooperate more with the United States or any other European country, we are going to cooperate with Russia no matter what sanctions you want to put on it. So again, he had some confidence in saying that no matter what the politicians decide, the business world really has the last word. And that company, Wintershall, has been working with Gazprom, the Russian company, for decades and has stakes in two large natural gas fields in western Siberia that connect to Nord Stream. So they have personal interest in that relationship, and they are also Germany's largest energy supplier in that field. So you can see that if the German government doesn't allow the cooperation to go on, certainly that would have a lot of ripple effects on Germany and Europe. And then you have BASF, another company that has more than 100,000 employees worldwide and leading in the chemical industry. So if you don't please that company, you can see that the German government is in trouble with that business world. Employees are losing their jobs and the business is crushing, and the German government has to contend with all these problems. So you can see the business world wants to cooperate with Russia. They have other options, obviously, but they want to cooperate with Russia. And there's not much the German government can do, apparently.
It's a strange relationship, isn't it? Russia, the pressure that other Western European nations are applying against Russia is certainly not without purpose, not without cause. Russia is doing a lot of things that are very concerning. And a lot of Eastern European nations are extremely concerned about just how aggressive Russia is showing itself to be. Ukraine, a hot spot, Crimea. There are these places where Russia is pressuring and pushing. It's trying to get these former Soviet states back into its orbit. Vladimir Putin has crushed democratic norms within his country. He's ruling as a dictator. There's a lot of problems here. This Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the reason why there's so much concern about it is it gives Russia a tremendous amount of power to distribute gas into Germany and into Europe by bypassing these pipelines that go through these Eastern European nations, so that it can use this as a weapon for these German businessmen to be basically pushing all of that aside and saying, no, we want to have a relationship with them. For Gerhard Schroeder, former German chancellor, to the moment he leaves office, immediately go to Gazprom and take a high profile position within that Russian energy company. This is very, very unusual, isn't it? I mean, you would say that there's a lot here that would be maybe pulling in opposite directions on these business leaders, or there's certainly there's a reason why they should be more cautious in their dealings with Russia. What is it that is driving them into Russia's arms like this?
Yes, and I believe that's one of the most alarming things. You would think maybe they don't read the news, but certainly they know more what's going on in Russia, they know more what's going on in Ukraine, and they know more about Putin's plan than we do. They have a personal relationship with him, they have meetings with him, they are going on many state visits. They're cooperating with the business leaders in Russia. So they know on a deeply personal level what's going on in Russia, how the employees are treated there, how the Russian people are treated. They know certainly that Putin is setting himself up more and more as a dictator. There's no way that we can expect any other leader in a democratic way to emerge from Russia. They see what's happening to the opposition in Russia. They see how they are being treated. And there are many public cases of even assassinations that might have been ordered directly from Putin. So there are many indications that this relationship is very dangerous. And certainly if you have a big corporation from Germany that's willing to enter such a corporation, it is alarming. But they also know that in this way, cooperating with Russia, they can bypass many of the norms that the West has set. They can make a profit of the profit that is Russia is making. The more Russia is rising, the more those business leaders are rising. So in a sense, they really want Putin to have more power. They want Putin to be the undemocratic leader that he is. The more he can advance his power, the more he can expand. It might harm the US, and the more it harms the US, the more it benefits Russia and the more they benefit. But it can't just be money. If you look at history, there are many such corporations that have been made at the cost of many lives. We have an article that goes through that, and I think it's from Andrew Miller, and it's called Germany and Russia's Secret Genocide. And he talks about the business leaders that have made a deal with Joseph Stalin at the time in the 1930s, that right before World War II, and it cost millions of lives in the Ukraine. They knew what they were doing, and the business leaders today have that history to look back on. They certainly know it, and they are still willing to do the very same at the same time as we see the pressure on Ukraine rising. So that's one of the most alarming signs that something sinister is going on behind the scenes. How much they have planned already, how much they know, how many lives it may cost, that we really can't know, but certainly they are willing, at least willing, to go the risk that Putin would do some major harm to Ukraine.
Richard Palmer wrote his trumpet brief on Monday on this subject. I would really recommend that you read this article from Richard, Why is Germany So Invested in Russia? And he goes through some of the history of the relationship between Germany and Russia that is extremely concerning. I guess we have two separate issues at stake here, and they both have interesting prophetic ramifications. One of them is the fact that you have German businessmen who are so powerful within the halls of German politics, and that they're exerting an influence that is, Angela Merkel says she can't resist. She has to give in to these businessmen. There's something there that it kind of echoes of the way that the industrialists played such a massive role in the rise of German power preceding World War II. And that's very well documented, the fact that they were relied on so heavily for Germany to achieve what it did during World War II. We see maybe a similar kind of relationship playing out. This other thing, the accommodation that we see between Germany and Russia, this is something that our editor-in-chief has drawn attention to repeatedly as a concern, that when you look at the way that those two, basically they accommodated one another as a means of being able to shore up that front between Germany and Russia so that they could attack elsewhere, that it basically an agreement between Germany and Russia presaged warfare elsewhere. And he said, not only is it likely that this would happen again before a World War III, but it may well have already happened. That accommodation has already taken place on some level. As you said, it's all very shady. You can't really know for sure, but when you see these types of situations unfolding, it seems like we're seeing the results of that kind of accommodation already in place.
That's correct, and you point to what Mr. Flui wrote about this, and at the time, in 2018, he stated that this cooperation over Nord Stream 2 is actually designed to break the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Mm-hmm. And at the time, that was a bold statement, but what we see now with the pressure on Ukraine and how the West tries to respond to that but really fails to have any stance that matters shows that the NATO is really fracturing here. They don't know how to respond to Russia, mainly because Germany is not cooperating. Russia is assembling all its troops at the borders of Ukraine, and NATO doesn't really have anything it can do to stop Russia at this point. And you see how those business leaders, really from the beginning, as they went underground, as the late Herbert W. Armstrong has warned, they went underground to prepare for the third round. And really that preparation is all about cooperating with Russia first to break the West. Otherwise, Germany would not be able to rise to power. So these two trends that you mentioned are really interconnected. The business leaders going underground, they are rising in influence in Germany, and at the same time, they are cooperating with Russia, while the German politicians officially say their main ally is the West.
Well, it's a big subject. It's something that we need to be watching closely. We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels about this German-Russia relationship and the role of German businessmen in German politics. He's written an article called Gazprom and Wintershall Cooperation with Historical Precedent. Richard Palmer's article from Monday, also very important, is called Why is Germany So Invested in Russia? And we look forward to the feature story from our editor-in-chief, an expansion of that Key of David program that he gave a couple of weeks back, Germany Going Underground. You can watch for that. This is for the coming edition of The Trumpet. But we'll link to these articles in the show notes, as well as that Key of David program. And we thank you very much for coming and talking to us about this today, Josue.
Thanks for having me, Mr.
And Eric. Before we quit, I just remembered, you are getting married this weekend.
Yes.
We have to give you some congratulations in advance for that. I'm very excited for you. When you come back the next time, you'll be a married man.
Different man, yes.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A new report from the director of the Center for Education at the Washington Policy Center shows that America's education system is failing. Government statistics show we're lagging behind other countries, that the problem gets worse the longer the kids are in school, and all the trends are heading in the wrong direction. What are the causes for this, and what are the effects? To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Yeah, I was going to just jump right in. I guess, yeah, for some years now, we've been hearing disturbing reports out of it. It always seems like it's Washington or California where you get the worst examples. But things like a teacher's teaching that Thanksgiving is a celebration of genocide, or math is racist, or I think I read a story once about a Washington teacher who told a little girl that she was really a boy trapped in a girl's body because she liked to go fishing, and just crazy stories. But this is this new report is really one of the more systematic evidence that this isn't just some crazy liberal teachers going rogue in a local classroom. But there's definitely a statewide effort, and even a nationwide effort, as we'll get to in a little bit, to transform the American education system. This report by Liv Finn, who is the director for the Center of Education at the Washington Policy Center, announces that, like, back in September, the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction announced new learning standards in English, art, history, social studies, math, and science. And these learning standards really deliberately lower the quality of Washington's existing education standards. Reading from the notable findings of this report, saying that really, instead of focusing on grammar, they don't want to teach English just as the art of grammar, but they really want to focus more on concepts of white supremacy, institutional racism, structural racism, and white privilege. I'm not even sure why those four things aren't synonyms, but apparently those are the four categories that they want to focus on their English instruction, and then also math and sciences as well, saying new math and science, they will still teach math, but they want to spend quite a bit of class time focusing on how math is used to oppress communities of color. Mm-hmm. And so really, stuff straight out of like the critical race theory playbook that is dividing students along racial lines, stirring up animosity, stirring up strife in the classroom, but at the same time, and just as significantly, dumbing down the students to where they now know more about critical race theory and white supremacy than they knew about grammar or algebra.
Mm-hmm. So you brought up the fact that we've all seen these headlines, and you know, you shake your head at just the misplaced priorities and the way that they're pushing this very radical social agenda on kids when they should be teaching basic stuff to these young people. This report kind of shows the cumulative effect that all of these kinds of the devolution of standards, academic standards, is having on these kids' educations. What do the statistics show on the effects of these programs?
Right, that particular report was really just going through the different standards that they're implementing in Washington, but there's also government data on a little bit more of a nationwide summation that's talking about the, that woman who wrote that report said, internationally, we do pretty well at the fourth grade, but from there we decline. And then some of the government data she cites shows that in 2019, the average fourth grader had a 41 proficiency level in mathematics, which still doesn't sound great, but apparently is somewhat average for the world. But then points out that said by the eighth grade, that drops down from 41% to 34%. And by the 12th grade, all the way down to 24%. Similar statistics in reading. Fourth graders have about an average reading proficiency of 35%. But by eighth grade, that drops slightly to 34%. And then by 12th grade, shows only a slight improvement to 37%. So I guess that decline's not as bad as the math. It does.
These are phenomenal statistics. 35% proficiency and drop in reading, dropping right to 34, rising to 37. This just seems extraordinarily low.
Yeah, it does actually. And I actually probably should have looked closer at that to figure if that, because it can't be like that's your grade for the year, because you'd have failed if you got a 34%. But
right,
obviously, if it's a percentage, then like perfection would be 100. And so you're looking at, you're only a third of the way proficient at this art of reading, and then even worse than that, and in mathematics. And so, like I said, those numbers seem pretty bad from the get-go. And then also just making the standpoint that, like, I'm sure other nations have their educational problems as well. But they're saying that, like, really once you get out of that fourth grade category into middle school and high school, America is just really falling behind the rest of the world, largely because they are focusing on things like social justice and critical race theory, and not actually on like the reading, writing, and arithmetic.
This is from the Epoch Times article on this. America's students fare worse in science, with fourth graders having only a 36% proficiency rate, eighth graders dropping to 35, 12th graders only 22 rate of proficiency in science. The worst scores come in history, with fourth graders starting out with only a 20% proficiency, dropping to 15% by eighth grade. By grade 12, America's students have a paltry 12% proficiency level in history.
Right.
History is definitely something that has been radically replaced. The understanding of history is now completely changed in the United States to being one that is entirely denigrating of our own history. Anything that is positive is thrown out. Anything that makes us look bad is exalted.
Right, and that's actually in those statistics. You're looking at 34% in history. Those proficiency statistics are based off the students not learning the history they're being taught, which in a lot of states like Washington is not even real history to begin with. So it's like even those, you get some of those topics like that, even those who do well in history are learning the version that paints the pilgrims as perpetrators of genocide.
So you point to the introduction of social justice education and so on as being one of the main causes. Does this Washington Policy Center, does it point to any other causes for these abysmal numbers?
It definitely focuses heavily on the critical race theory and the social justice agenda, showing that they're just the school boards are not teaching the actual life skills of reading, writing, arithmetic, and other subjects. It's also true that there is a in many states, not just Washington, a pronounced shortage of qualified teachers. Where that report says we don't expect our teachers to be particularly well educated, and they're not trained to teach the science of reading. So basically, we have a public school system that is negligently instructing children how to read, and it's been going on for decades. And then a little later on, she explains kind of like the negative feedback loop, this vicious cycle of like when you have a teacher shortage. In order to get the teachers you need, it prioritizes you to like lower the standards for your teachers, and so the teachers you do get are less qualified, and so you kind of have two competing but like enhancing trends here. Or one, you've got these like social justice warrior teachers with an agenda to come in here and teach students about communism and critical race theory and social justice warriors. And two, because of the shortage, you're also just getting people in here who don't really want to be there, or who don't know what they're doing because they're just looking for someone to fill a position when there's such a shortage in the nation.
It's particularly ironic to see these results when you have this debate going on over these school board meetings, where the elites and the people on these school boards are saying parents are not qualified to make decisions about curricula, and we need to be the ones. This is really the purview of professionals to oversee these things, and we're the ones that should be determining what curricula the children are being instructed by and so on. Parents that have a problem with this are basically operating outside of their area of expertise. The reality is the fruits of these experts is abysmal.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually a really good point, is that you would think there'd be a little bit more humility with these teachers and government figures who are coming out and, like I said, in many cases just point blankly said that parents shouldn't have a say what their teachers are taught, or what their students are taught, what their children are taught. they should leave it up to the professionals when you've got report after report after report showing that America is falling behind the rest of the world because of how the professionals are running things. You'd think just a little common sense would be like, well, maybe if we went back to how we used to do things when the parents were more involved, that would be a good thing for the nation. I remember it was about 14 years ago, if I'm thinking this right, they were wallpaping over or re-renovating a one-room schoolhouse in Kentucky. And came across a final exam for eighth grade. And that exam had questions on the Greek language, questions on the Latin language, questions on trigonometry. You had to like explain what happened at the Battle of Marathon. You had to like solve that if a British ship left England and went to the Philippines through the Suez Canal, name every body of water, bay, see that it would cross on the way. I think it's like they had an online version. I took it and passed with a B, and I had like 8 years of college at the time. And so just looking back over this this 100-long-year period, I mean, my great-grandmother used to always kind of lament the fact that she wished she was more educated because, like, life circumstances, she had to, like, drop out of school after eighth grade in the 1920s, although you could argue that like the level of education she received at the eighth grade in the 1920s was better than a high school graduate today, potentially even better than like a four-year college degree today, depending on how devoted you were. So when you and parents were very involved in that type of teaching back then. So, but you can see the fruits of that. Like when you focus on the reading, you focus on the writing, you focus on the arithmetic, you focus on the other cores, you get your parents involved, and now you've got middle schoolers who are as smart as the college educated people today.
Now, what we really haven't talked about is why this is happening and how it seems like there really is a deliberate effort to dumb down the education. Everything that we're describing hasn't even taken into account the all of the COVID lockdowns and restrictions and the effect that has had, just devastating children's education. You've got so many kids that have been educated. Either there've been whole segments of the curriculum that just blotted out, or they've been taking classes online with disengaged teachers, and they're kind of flaking out. The kids, they're not really paying attention to what's going on in the classroom. So there's a black period in the kids' education over the last 2 years, really, that has had even more devastation. And it's the same elites that have promoted the lockdowns and the school closures that are the ones pushing for these social justice curricula. This isn't just educators taking their eye off the ball, is it? This is really a deliberate effort to dumb down education.
Right. I think the school lockdowns due to COVID are a really good example of that, just in the fact that, I mean, the lockdowns, they're unconstitutional and they're illegal. But from a quarantine standpoint, I mean, maybe you could make an argument that locking down a nursery home of the elderly would save a few lives. But COVID's actually no worse than the flu, probably less worse than the flu for children.
Right.
And so locking down a school and creating a circumstance where many children are basically a year behind where they should be because of these lockdowns is either just gross stupidity or like malevolence, like a deliberate effort to dumb down the current generation. And there's definitely precedent for that. I mean, you hear a lot about the communist infiltration of politics, and that is the dumbing down of the population is a big part of that. Like, so the Epoch Times, which is produced by an organization that had to flee communist China, and so they're have some firsthand experience on how they operate. They've produced actually a 2-volume series I even brought with me entitled How the Specter of Communism is Ruling Our World. And if you go the chapter 12, it's the first chapter of the second volume, is actually titled Sabotaging Education. And they've got, here's one statement that I highlighted, so it jumped out at me. It says, the complete breakdown of American education is one of the most distressing things to have happened to the country in the past few decades. It signals the success of communism's mission to infiltrate and corrupt Western society. And that chapter, it goes all the way back to about the time my great-grandmother got out of eighth grade. Talking about like when John Dewey, who's considered like the father of American progressive education, started implementing new standards back then, that the Soviet Union was in the middle of a civil war at the time, and they still took the effort to translate John Dewey's books into Russian. They wanted to teach those methods so badly. And so the Russians embraced them even more wholeheartedly than America did. But the Soviet Union and the Americans have kind of been using the same atheistic, humanistic, materialistic playbook for their education system for about the past 100 years. And some of that manifests itself as actually teaching socialism or sexually libertine values that the communists actually believe in. But they also make the point that some of that is, like I said, communism, it teaches socialist economics, which doesn't work, but it doesn't necessarily have anything against physics. But in a nation like America, there can still be a concerted effort to like dumb down math skills just to make people easier to control, so they can't actually think for themselves. There's actually one other quote in here that if I can actually find it. Okay, this is from actually a report the Reagan administration made in 1983. So this is actually going back some time, but it's really showing when this kind of started, where it's entitled A Nation at Risk. And it says, the educational foundations of our society are presently being eroded by a rising tide of mediocrity that threatens our very future as a nation and as a people. If an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose on America the mediocre educational performance that exists today, we might well have viewed it as an act of war. As it stands now, we have allowed this to happen to ourselves.
It's quite something. And It is very sad, I think, to see what's happening to our young people, and to know this is the nation's future. The education that we give to the next generation does determine our future. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about declining academic standards in America, what some of the causes of that are. We really appreciate your time, Andrew. We will link to an article in the show notes, What Is Your Child Learning in Public School, from The Trumpet, from a couple years back. Thanks so much for your time.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Can 1+1=0? Well, only if you're involved in a medical system that says a body poisoned by food can be cured with toxic medicine. For millions of people, this math will have a tragic ending. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, holistic nutritionist and personal trainer, Jörg Mardian. Hello.
Hello there.
Whenever people get sick, whenever things go wrong in the human body, it seems like the medical industry's primary response is drugs. I was listening to an interview with a doctor, extended interview that was related to some of the issues that came up with that have come up with COVID, and it was just stunning to me how facile he was at rattling off this drug and that drug. And I mean, over the course of, you know, a fairly lengthy interview, he had to have mentioned about 25 different drugs that he would be prescribing in this case or that case. What is your view in terms of what causes disease and that kind of an approach?
Right. Well, there's a missing dimension between cause and effect when doctors talk about that. So the primary cause, as we see it in the natural field, is food. I mean, it's what we take in all day long. There are other factors, of course. But if we're looking at chronic diseases today, I mean, the statistics say there's 7 out of 10 U.S. deaths are responsible due to chronic diseases. Doctors know that. It's killing about 1.7 million Americans annually. And those stats are well proven. I think it's a highly preventable statistic, you know, just based on simple addition and subtraction. You eat healthy foods and avoid what's harmful. And again, it's not just foods. I now just want to emphasize that, but it is the main factor. So that explanation may be simple, but the implementation seems to be really challenging for a lot of people because of the type of foods that we're getting. So there's a book called The Dorito Effect, very interesting book. And it says that we're mesmerized by these strange foods like tubes of Go-Gurt, Twinkies that stay fresh forever, veggie puffs and cheesies, stuff like that, right? They're not really foods. They're just food-like substances with extreme taste, uh-huh. And they hook us, right? So, and it ensures that we don't stop eating them. And it also overrides the impulse to check if they're healthy. So we just want them, and we don't even check. So, I mean, who looks for chemicals and additives and flavor enhancers when you can't stop eating this stuff?
Right.
So in truth, really, these type of foods define everything that's wrong with modern food. And they're just a perfect mixture for creating chronic disease. So if we look at the lost economic productivity cost baked into that, it amounts to about $3.7 trillion in annual healthcare costs.
$3.7
trillion. $3.7 trillion.
You're attributing directly to eating that kind of food, the kind of non-foods that you're talking about.
As well as lost economic productivity costs, according to the American Action Forum. And the British Medical Journal entry, there's a 2019 entry that says these type of foods that are, they're really contaminated foods, right? They cause a 62% increase in all-cause mortality if you eat 4 or more daily servings.
Boy.
That's what I said, boy. You know, that's, I mean, that's bad news because they make up half of America's calories right now. And it leads to America having the lowest life expectancy, the highest disease, chronic disease burden, and an obesity rate at twice that of relative to 10 other high-income countries, according to a study by the Commonwealth Fund. It's really staggering. And, you know, there was another study called the Global Burden of Disease Study, and it says the evidence is just clear. Poor diet is the number one cause of premature death in America. But on the other hand, not taking in enough healthy foods is just as bad because we're depriving the body of the nutrients that we need. Mm. So we're eating the unhealthy ones, but we're not putting in the healthy ones. So there's a simple math again, right? That even if you take out what's bad, you still have to put in what's good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to reverse that trend, of course, eat foods that are nutritionally superior and they act as natural medicines for the body that maintain, prevent, and treat disease.
Well, this is really interesting. You're taking this overview, this big picture of what is happening, say, with the health of Americans, and this is true of many other nations as well. America is probably the tip of the spear on this point. But we are in a healthcare crisis right now. There's so much attention being fixed on how unhealthy people are and trying to keep people healthy and doing everything that we possibly can to keep people healthy and demanding that they, you know, take all of these extreme measures to avoid this one disease, this one virus that's causing problems in a small number of people. But you're talking about something that's affecting millions upon millions of people. And really, there's not much done about this, if anything, the way that the medical fraternity tends to view it, or the vast majority of them, they're not even factoring food consumption and the quality of food in healthcare costs.
Well, that's true. The root cause, again, is ignored. And then, so we say, well, that doesn't exist, so we have to, you know, act upon it with what I call the cure that kills. The cure is supposedly medicine, right? I mean, right now, 60 to 70% of Americans take at least one prescribed drug, depending on the estimate out there. And that's just a handful of pills every day for some. And it's just a sad testament to how reflexively we throw medicines at our diseases without addressing what the actual problem is. Mm-hmm. So the mistake we make with this approach, and what few look at, is how tightly regulated the body's complex chemical structure is. And usually hormones make chemical adjustments in the body that regulate all the processes. And pharmaceuticals, what they do when we throw them at a disease, they take the place of one of those processes, right? And but what they do is they can disturb the interconnected balance of all the chemicals. They don't address that. So they may alter other unrelated molecules even, and then that gives just some really distressing side effects. And what that really does is, and the side effects are famous. Just listen to a commercial.
Right.
And that leads us to the dilemma of deciding what's worse, the original disease or the adverse effects of the drug.
Right.
You know, so the bottom line is if a disease creates or if a drug, I'm sorry, a drug creates a complication of a normal bodily function, that's labeled a disease. All right. So by one estimate, you know, Americans are taking prescribed medications is the fourth leading cause of death among Americans.
Taking prescribed medications is the fourth leading cause of death among Americans.
That is correct. You
so
won't see
presumably
that
they're taking these medications to try to treat another problem that they have, and then they end up being killed from it.
Well, you get a litany of problems all of a sudden. You're disturbing processes. So you take one medicine, it disturbs another process in the body because it's interconnected. Then you take another medicine to take care of that process.
Right.
A medicine will usually take care of a singular issue. Not all of them, but most of them will do that. And then all of a sudden you're on a handful to take care of what the previous one should have done, but then you have side effects. Another one takes care of the side effect, and another one takes care of those side effects.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're on 8 or 10 medicines. And again, we're not addressing the root cause of all of that, are we? So the medicinal approach is of healing is not to bring the body to a balanced state. That's not its intent. It creates more imbalance with chemicals. So the question of whether this approach really is effective was explained by Herbert Armstrong in his book, The Plain Truth About Healing. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing this a little bit, he said the use of a medicinal poison to counteract a body poisoned by unhealthy foods is absurd medical math. It's a concept so elementary that even a second grade student could understand it.
Yeah.
It's one poison plus one poison should be two poisons. But they say a medicine is not a poison. Well, you know, the statistics tell us that. So it's really what I call the alternate fake news. it's designed to continue enlarging our already bloated healthcare crisis. I mean, nobody's looking at it. I'm sure it's, you know, doctors aren't out there saying, well, we're going to do this on purpose. But it's known. The side effects are well known. So I would say, you know, to our listeners that when you hear something like this, when you're listening to something, the first thing to do is to do your own study as well. I mean, there's a lot of information out there. A lot of us just don't go and read enough information. It does take some time. I continuously have to update. Once you understand the truth, once you hear the truth, you know, about the existence of physical, biological laws that we're really talking about here, that bring about good health, then there's a responsibility that has to be met if you want to keep or maintain good health or to bring it about.
Yeah.
Let's say your body is now, you're currently suffering. Well, it doesn't mean you have to continue suffering. There's a lot you can do. We're not talking about curing anything, but we're talking about bringing your body back to a balance so that the process in the body can actually start to work again and you're not contributing to the continual poisoning. The food today, if we're not careful, is a poison. Mm-hmm. We have to be careful. Medicines, and that's what I'm trying to say. Not everybody's on medicines, of course, but many, many people are. The medicine is a poison. So here's the math. One plus one, two poisons, that's two. That's just an elementary concept. It's never zero, you know. And that's the proper nutritional math that helps you reduce the risk of future disease. And almost immediately when you apply it and when you dig into it and make a consistent effort, gives you a better quality of life, you know. I would say the book that I talked about here, The Plain Truth About Healing, that's just an amazingly wonderful book. If our readers dig into that book, and that can be found on thetrumpet.com, that will give just vital information on the subject we just discussed.
You know, if there's a lesson that we can take from, say, the crisis that's going on right now, you see all of these conflicts of interest among all of the parties involved when you talk about pharmaceutical companies that are manufacturing these medicines and doctors who are prescribing them and government agencies that are approving them. There's a lot of overlap in their interests that do not overlap with the interests of the patient in so many cases. And it should give you pause. You're talking about going out and seeking your own, trying to get the information that you need on your own. It can be challenging because there is a lot of information out there. There's also a lot of conflicting information out there. But the idea that you would basically just go to, you know, your neighborhood family physician and just say, what do I need? And just take whatever he gives you without any real concern or looking into what does this drug actually do? That's something that we should take a warning from what's happening all over the world right now with the medical community. Well, we've been talking with personal trainer and holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about treating disease through medication and the problems associated with that. He's working on an article that should appear soon on this subject at thetrumpet.com. And he also mentioned that booklet, The Plain Truth About Healing. That is a booklet that we would be happy to send you if you request it. And we'll send it to you for free. Thanks so much, Jörg. Great to have you on.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
What's the hardest thing for a human being to do? Thanks to pernicious human nature, of all the strenuous, formidable, even heartbreaking things you can face, perhaps the most difficult is this: when you're wrong, to truly admit it so you can change it. This truth came to mind watching congressional testimony from a top FBI agent. This man was involved in investigating Hillary Clinton's email scandal, Russia's involvement in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, the Trump-Russia dossier, the leak of the Democratic National Committee emails, and on and on and on. This man was also committing adultery with an FBI colleague. The thousands of text messages he exchanged with her communicated his bias against Trump and his supporters. But when this man's actions were exposed, the world found out about his adultery, his political prejudice, and his obvious motivation to use his power to damage a presidential candidate, he was called before members of Congress to give nationally televised testimony accounting for his actions. And there, this guilty man boldly, consistently, and defiantly insisted he was perfectly innocent. The more evidence of his wrongdoing that was laid before him, the more combative and condescending he became. When one congressman questioned his integrity, he called that insulting. He said, "I take offense." His defiance included a smirk so noticeable that a congressman called him out on it, saying he wondered how often the man had looked into his wife's eyes and lied about his adultery. Somehow, this individual had managed to rise to a very high position, paid with American tax dollars, within a high-level law enforcement agency. To me, that speaks volumes about the current state of America's government. But as unique and egregious as this man's situation is, his spirit of the self being right, even when shown to be wrong, has become common in America. In fact, it's prevailed throughout human history, and it can easily plague your own life. The question is, what happens to those who never admit fault, who never accept correction? Proverbs 29 verse 1 says, "He that being often reproved hardens his neck shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. Like a plane whose yoke is never turned or pulled, they fly off course and crash." The truth is, we are pitiful blind creatures without God. Yet naturally, we take on the mindset of the devil, who won't admit his failures and will still be insisting on his innocence and righteousness when he's finally cast into outer darkness. This is the fundamental reason why human civilization has a history and an immediate future dominated by misery, injustice, strife, and failure, because man naturally rejects correction. America is a colossal example. This nation is being chastened, corrected, and humbled in countless ways, yet this isn't arousing in people any spirit of contrition or sense of repentance. People on every side of every issue are just digging in deeper, doubling down on the supposed correctness of their own position. With engines on full throttle and the mountainside coming into view, we still insist self is right. But we all need correction. You know, there's nothing sweeter than a child who's done something wrong and who responds to his parents' correction and turns away from a wrong attitude and toward a humble repentance. Well, God is a loving Father, and He'll give us loving correction, not just through troubles and curses, but through the pages of His Word and through His servants, if only we will accept it. Here are four quick points to taking advantage of God's precious correction. One, stop fighting it. Acknowledge that you have a deep-seated carnal resistance to being corrected. You've got to get rid of that resentment. Two, pray for it. Regularly pray that God will correct you in His mercy. You need that persistent contact with God in order to live the way of God is right, not self is right. Three, accept it. Correction will come in different forms. Don't focus on the means by which it comes. Focus on whether it is true. And four, apply it. If you humble yourself enough to do the first three points, it doesn't get you anywhere if you don't follow through and put the correction into action. Hebrews 12 and verse 5 says, "My son, despise you not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives." Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has talked about just how important it is to embrace correction and to thank God for it. When you apply correction and you accept it and embrace it, it always brings growth and blessings. Like flying a plane, Living a good human life requires constant correction, adjustment, and improvement. And what happens to those who are correctable before God is not just a good life, but achieving their incredible human potential. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Joshua Michels, Andrew Miller, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Ronald Reagan. The greatest leader is not necessarily the one who does the greatest things. He is the one that gets the people to do the greatest things. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.